Okay, and following my tradition, I'm going to tell you a little joke to start. I like this joke because it's a good teaching story, and it's a little morbid at first, so I don't want you to get shocked by it because it's a joke. It has a purpose. So this is about, and some of you have heard this before, it's about a group of fundraising ladies. They're the top fundraising ladies on the planet. And they're on their in their tour bus doing their work. The bus goes over the cliff. They all die. And they make their way to the pearly gates. They meet Saint Peter. Saint Peter, he goes, "Ladies, very nice to see you. Let's see, let me see now. You ladies have to go to hell." So he sends them down to hell. A week goes by. God gets on the telephone. "Peter, it's God. Where is my fundraising ladies? They're supposed to be here by now." Peter says, "Oh, I guess I made a mistake. I sent them down to hell." God says, "It's okay. Lucifer works for me. Let me give him a call." "Lucifer, it's God. Have you seen my fundraising ladies?" He says, "Have I seen them? They've only been here 1 week. They've raised enough money to air condition the whole place." And I think someone told me that someone wrote a book. Wherever you go, there you'll be. I thought that was such an original thought on my part, but someone's already written a book on it. Yeah. So, in some way, you can think that this life is preparation for the next life, but this life is preparation for this life because this life will have many forms in many places. And wherever you go, the kind of glasses you're wearing will be the glasses you'll see through, and the kind of activities you're skillful at will be the skillful means you'll have, and the fears you have, you'll don't think that some you do a kind of couple of good things here and then you go to heaven and everything is hunky-dory. It's very naive. Would you agree? It's just naive. I do feel like I explained yesterday morning or the evening before that there is a temporary vacation, where you in that first stage of the bardo that you really are welcomed into yourself, into the wholesomeness of heart and joy and beauty. And it's a great relief. But maybe to go a little further in what the teachings of the Bardo, which line up biblical, Jewish, if you look between the notes, and especially I think that we can refer to Tibetan, Padmasambhava's teaching on Tibetan Book of the Dead, this descriptions of the Bardos. And we can also go to NDE experiences to educate ourselves, near-death experiences. Excuse me. So often what's described next is the opportunity to see your whole life pass before you. So first, a cessation of pain. Traveling through a passageway, like similar to what? Birth, yeah. Greeted by a guide and feeling the sense of profound belonging. So that sense of lack of self-worth, lack of unworthiness, self-sabotage, none of that is going to arise in that field. It's so powerful. You know, it's like, you know. But now, life's review. And what Murshid Sam would say, he says, in the Bible, it's called the Day of Judgment. And he says, I want you to take note. It's called the Day of Judgment. It's not the Night of Judgment. So in other words, it happens in the light. So it's not creepy. Imagine, now, how many of you have done your banking on your computer? So I used to use a program called Quicken. Okay, they don't make it for Mac anymore, but I used to use that. And you know, you'd balance your accounts. You'd basically balance what you thought you had compared to what the bank said you had. You know, fact against fiction or whatever. Right? Or whatever. When you got on Quicken, when the bottom numbers were the same, a banner would come down on the screen with balloons and it said, congratulations. So it didn't mean you don't owe anything anymore. It just meant you've taken account. You know where you stand. And so a life's review has that capacity. And now you know in this life right now, here's an example. I send out wazifa practices for my murids, and one time I had sent out just the wazifa alone for accounting for your life. There's several. There's Ya Muhsi and there's Ya Hasib. One of the roots of Ya Hasib is to count the number of hairs on your head, you know. So, you know, taking an account. And I got a lot of feedback during that period. I didn't like that wazifa. You know. I don't want to. There's a sense in us that we just, oh no, we're just supposed to feel happy, not take account. Not that taking account should make you feel unhappy, but in our current condition, it often does, because we've covered over seeing the details of the picture, and when we see them, we're not as intoxicated about our condition as we were. It's a little sobering. Right. So we need practice in accounting now. So whenever we get an opportunity to account, it's not creepy. Make sense? Yeah. And it's the same thing as I said yesterday. We want to develop the skillful means to make friends with life, to be at ease with whatever arises. And certainly that's one of the central aspects of meditation, to just relax into the natural swing of the breath and keep relaxing no matter what arises. So you could say you are attentive, have inquiry into the moment without an agenda. When you have an agenda, then you have a life's review, you're in trouble. You with me? So, and again, I want to remind you, Nayad's teachings, that in this realm, the will is operative. You know, it's really strong and allows us to regain our balance when we're upset. In the Bardo realms, the way he tries to describe it is that the imagination is much more operative and the will not so accessible. And I know how it is in my dreams when there's just this looping thing going on and I'm trying to, can't I navigate out of here, you know? And so You know, somehow this leads me to give you another important teaching. We haven't really talked much about the mysticism of breath, but most of you have practiced it. At the center, the very, very center of our lineage is the mysticism of breath and learning to make a habit of a refined, relaxed, rhythmic breath, balancing the inhalation and the exhalation. After this, I'll read you some teachings on it. So that covers inhalation and exhalation and balance, but that teaching doesn't cover right nostril and left nostril, which is another factor that affects our condition. So in the yoga systems and the Sufi systems, quite the same. Sufi, we would say Jalal and Jamal. Right Jalal, left Jamal. Yoga system, sun and moon. Jalal means a strong Jamal beauty, you know. So which nostril would you want open when you went to sleep? Left. Jamal. Yeah, I know you meant that. Yeah. Yeah, no, I heard your minds. Okay. Jamal. Everyone understand? Yeah. So the instruction Hazrat Inayat Khan gives is to, as you go to sleep, put your breath in rhythm and open your left nostril. I raised my hand in class with Murshid Sam. Murshid, what's the best fikr, what's the best sacred phrase to place on the breath for going to sleep? He said, do toward the one, right? So how do you get your left nostril open? You lie on your right side. If you're lying on your right side, your left nostril is skyward and it automatically opens. So for 45 years, I've had the habit of, you know, getting my breath in rhythm, rolling onto my right side, reciting toward the one with the natural sway of the breath with the left nostril open. Through that practice, gradually, I have much more consciousness or navigational ability in my dream life. I'm not saying I have navigation ability. I have more than none, but I have some. And it's very similar to, any of you practice the Tibetan dream yoga? Tibetan dream yoga. So it's part of the Tibetan training. Their method is really nasty. You have a partner, and the minute they see you're dreaming, they wake you up and ask you where you were, because you're practicing to be aware in your dream condition. You know, so it's the same principle. And it's a lot more delightful, because even when there's whatever you want to call it, demonic, you know, that's too big a word, but you know, unpleasantness going on, it's part of you going like, this is interesting, you know. So you can navigate through it. And when you are really conscious, then you realize in your dream, you're tremendous freedom. I mean, okay, everybody try to fly. Come on. I haven't been able to fly in this realm. But I can fly in my dream realm all the time. And not only that, it's very exhilarating. So when I come back from that kind of dream, I feel, whew, back to the bardos, back, you know, that part of the teaching clear? Oh, so the complement of it is, when you wake up, which nostril would you want open? Right. You want to have strength to go into the world. It's the same in India in the yoga systems. You begin with your right foot, you breathe in the right nostril, you go to, you know. So how would you do that? You lie on your left side. So it's not that difficult. While you're sleeping, you just make a habit of, before you wake up, you roll on your left side, your right nostril opens, and yes. Okay. Yeah, but it's not going to work if you're lying on your if you're lying on your left side and you do this the minute.
If you're on your back. You're laying on your back.
Oh, I see. Yeah, here's your position for sleeping. It's all right. Okay, I want you to know. So some of you have studied the planetary walks, which deals with breathing in the different nostrils in a very educational way, that it's an amazing capacity that you have that you might not know about. Okay, right now, just breathe. Have your mind tell your nostrils, breathe in the right side. Go ahead. I don't know, very good for some of you. Okay, now, have your mind tell your body, breathe in the left nostril. No, don't use your fingers. Forget the fingers, just mind. Okay, well, if it didn't work, it's not hard. I'm not anything special. I didn't do anything. I just, mind said do it, and it cooperated. So if you don't have that synapse lined up, it'll come very quickly. But, you know, go right ahead. We do it in Sufi breathing practices too. It's right there. Yeah. Yeah. It's in the yoga systems, it's called going through the gunas. You know, yeah. No, I'm very aware of it. Yeah. What's a what machine? Oh, I see. Here's an important thing. If you tell someone to walk in rhythm and they don't have legs, they can't do that. So they have to accommodate their condition. And some people have deviated septum. They're not going to be able to do this. So they just have to go to the next level. You can't take your body on it, you have to take your mind on it. So we have to honor our capacities and incapacities. And I don't have enough understanding of I'd have to observe how the breathing, what do you call it, sleep apnea machine works. It's not, Exactly. So breathing in the left calls the body to its Jamal nature. And like Sabura is saying, if you can't do it with your body, go to the next level. But, so specifically, I'd have to observe it or try it and then see what you could do. Okay. All right. Oh, nice. Where the attention goes, the energy flows. So, yeah, that's beautiful. Okay, back to the bardos. Now I'm describing really the bardos according to the teaching of 8th century master Padmasambhava, supposedly born on a lotus flower. And not only that, but in the 8th century, he said, when the iron bird flies and horses run on wheels, the Dharma will come to the land of the red men. So if you think he's, if you would honor him because he's a good predictor. In the 8th century, he said, he wrote down the prediction, when the iron bird flies and horses run on wheels, the Dharma, you know, the teachings of the Dharma, will come to the land of the red men. Wow. Super wow. Subhanallah. Yeah, exactly. So, life's review. You know, here's the screen. We're going to pull it down. This is your life, Shabd Khan. You know, oh, look, and I, well, wait, turn away. So, if you have that attitude of, oh, it's really good to take account. Wow. Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm going to have to do some work over, around that. You know, I'm open. Instead of defending or, you know, not wanting to be, you know. And now imagine you're in the dream state when this is happening. You know, when you're, so that stage of the bardo is a real opportunity to have skillful means to learn wisdom about where you need to direct your capacities to. Clear? The last stage in the bardo's in the Padmasambhava's teachings is about taking rebirth. Some teachings talk about the five different realms, some talk about six realms. So I can't help you too much, except I can say I know about human realm, which is the one we, most of us are involved in and often will come back to. No matter what realm, I'm confident, like the fundraising ladies, if I've developed skills in fundraising, wherever I'm going to go, I'm going to have fundraising skills. I mean, that's why I told you that silly joke. So I'm not worried. I'm not fearful here. Why would I be fearful in some other realm? Things might be different. It might be easier. They might be harder. Whatever. You know. It's easier in Prescott. It's more difficult in Yugoslavia, you know. You know, that doesn't even exist anymore. But it's called something else. But whatever. You understand my meaning. So in that last stage of the bardo, we become involved in choosing, attracting those beings that will give birth to us and bring us into incarnation. So if you have a wisdom body is active, then you're very clear that you want to take birth on this path of awakening, you know, for service and love, serve, and remember, you know, for the benefit of all. And now you're going to choose mother, father on those terms. But then if you're in a more ordinary condition where greed, lust, aversion are active, then it's typical if you're going into choose into a male body, you'll fall in love with the mother and jealous of the father, or, you know, vice versa. And so the choices that you make will create a less beneficial birth for the activity of waking up. So we want to bring, you know, when that, you know, if we just take note of it here, then when that arises, you go, oh, yeah, wait, let me, some part of your consciousness already knows, let me bring my wisdom being, you know, into this operation. I don't know about you, but I've got a wisdom being and I've got a lust being. You know, it's operative. I'm aware of it. The lust being shows up. I don't say, you're bad. I just say, oh, nice to see you again. Come and meditate with me. In other words, come and join me in this effort to wake up. Inviting everything along. All right? Yeah. Yes. Women. Well, you're making up a different joke. They could do it. It was hell and they could do it.
So they have to find a way to get around that.
We will apply our skills wherever we go. Wherever we go. When we go to Safeway, it's still going to be us. When we go to Whole Foods, it'll be us. If we don't like the person in front of us in line, we could be critical, you know. And we could be critical in Safeway too. And we could be critical in hell, if that's worse. You know, wherever we go, if we're critical, we'll be critical. If we are kind and we're in line with someone, we'll be kind to the person that's a mess. Kindness will come forward. Fundraising. Don't worry about the fundraising.
No,
yeah. Yeah, kindness.
I'm
and,
using that as a,
yeah, yeah. So did I answer your question? No. So rephrase the question then.
Well, I think he's looking how to get past blocks to things that you want to be able to, or that you feel you're naturally.
Okay, well, so I got inner guidance to build this dharga. Okay? If in your language, I would had a lot of blockage. I just stayed with the guidance. I didn't go, this is too much. I've had enough. I'd get a blow or whatever, you know, a critic, you know, an insult. It would hit me and then I go, okay, let that relax. Stay on my point. I'm going to stay on my point. I want to wake up for the benefit of sentient beings. That's what I want to do. Wake up for the benefit of sentient beings. I'm on my point. Blocking is a good thing. We're calling it blocking. It's showing you are not able to have limitless freedom in this condition. So we're providing this condition so you have an opportunity to relax yourself and be limitlessly free in every condition. So block is just a concept that we have, that blocking. Nobody told me in the 8 years I shouldn't be limitlessly free. But there were many opportunities when my sense of limitless freedom was put into question. Causes and conditions, yeah. I misread the situation. I thought it would be, oh yeah, they'd go, oh, that is so beautiful. It would make Lama beautiful. Thank you. Wow, you want to put all this energy toward us? That's fantastic. That's what they should have said. Just kidding. No, everybody has every point of view is good. I'm not trying to say mine was the right point of view. I'm just joking. World is mind. So, if you have the, you know, things will look like the way your mind understands things. So very much for a Tibetan, it will look with all the images of the bardos, but for us, the images are going to be different because we have different culture and different superstitions and so on. And so I remember there was some bad star something signed for my Tibetan teacher, and they were doing a mo, you know, like a prediction thing of what to do. And he said, you don't have to bother with this because you don't follow this superstition. It doesn't apply to you. But I want to expand something, first of all. So I've given a kind of linear line. It looks very linear, and it's too simple. But it also does line up very well with a lot of the NDE reports. So just trying to find resonance between scientific, you know, I came back from here and this is what I experienced, and Padmasambhava's teachings and Anayat Khan's teachings, trying to find the resonance between them. But I think you have to, It's like reading a guidebook. You read a guidebook before you go, you know, we're going to Istanbul. You know, if we were good tourists, we would read the guidebook. Let's see, you know. But when you see the place, it's different than someone told you to look over here. Now you're looking. So that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is you have to expand your linear thinking, because I'll give you an example with my own son. Well, let me give you the example first with my teacher, Merchant Samuel Lewis. He, before he died, he was teaching us from his commentaries on Anayat Khan. They're called Akibayat, Life After Death. And in the class, it was in December, so what I remember clearly him repeating again and again, the connection between the Murshid and the Murid, between the student and the teacher, is in no way dependent on one or the other being in the body. And I, you know, because I was naive and also trusted my teacher, when he died, part of me thought, okay, he said that, there it is. And many of you know that to be true. Especially with him. Even with my students who are alive now, now the term I use is the coconut wireless. That we can guide each other through the coconut wireless. And it works well for me and for many of my students. So, but then now it's a different thing out of this realm. And the coconut wireless is still operative. So, according to the Bardo teachings, you know, a year later, Sam must have reincarnated in some realm. And simultaneously, somehow, he's able to be present to me in his old form and guide me. Okay, so that's, in a linear thinking, that doesn't work. You agree? But experientially, it's working. So you have to open your heart and mind to something you can't, you know, make a mathematical equation for. Yeah. So I expanded. Now, we could excuse that because from our invocation, it says united with all the illuminated souls. So that idea that through illumination, a being can multitask. You know, they can be all-pervading, and so they can, the spirit of guidance can serve the humanity through any form, and especially the form of an illuminated being. But now, okay, so my son passes away. Naturally, since I have a connection with Tibetan Bardo teachings, I'm making aspirations for him according to the stage of the Bardos and having a conversation, a coconut wireless conversation, making aspirations for the stages he's at. I assume, rightly or wrongly, I can't say, that he's taken rebirth, but that doesn't mean I don't have communication with him. In the form I knew him as, you know, it's usually in dreams, and when he'll show up, I'll go like, "Well, that's curious. You look great, you know. Wow, you know." We usually hug, and he says, "I'm doing great," and that's that, you know. So that kind of relaxes things because there's something bigger going on. From one point of view, the whole universe is mind. There's only the spirit of guidance. And from that point of view, it all becomes easy to understand. Yeah, but I think it's very important what you said, that our experience will look like our thoughts. Yeah, well, fine. You know, the more important thing is how do you feel right now? You know, what are you feeling? You know, yeah, I think it's good for us to relax our conceptual mind. You know, My teacher, 12th Taisitu Rinpoche, my Tibetan teacher, he's the chief disciple of the Karmapa, who's now in his 17th incarnation, and he's called the knower of the three times. You know, so in other words, past, present, future are open to him when he needs to. And at the same time, he's now 25 or 26 or 27. He's traveling around teaching and so on. And you can also see that he's a young man learning life in this form. And but I'll give you a story on him. So in his first incarnation, he leaves a letter and he gives it to his disciple and says, please come to pick me up in a year at, you know, Shivadham and Parvati. Here's the address. You know, he gives the name of the parents. They don't have addresses in Tibet. You know, it's more the third mountain to the left, you know. So he has left a letter. He's the only human being who has this capacity. Dalai Lamas are not found like that. None of the other Rinpoches. He leaves instruction before departing each incarnation where to come get him. Okay, so again, that's way beyond our, except what I suggested, just let it relax your view and be delightful, like, wow. You know, wow. So there's a beautiful story about him. I think it was between 9th and 10th incarnation, but I don't remember. Because he's so extraordinary in Tibet, you know, when he does a ceremony, 10,000 people, 20,000 people will walk and they'll come. And at the end of the ceremony, everyone files by, you know, to get a blessing. And, you know, if you were to go to a simple thing, there'd be 40, 50 people and you'd all come by and there'd be a personal. But, you know, when there's 20,000, he's throwing rice over a line walking by, you know. Well, you could imagine 20,000 people to file by. That's a lot. You know, it's like the Pope kind of thing. So you know, I always think they're going to get rice elbow instead of tennis elbow. Anyway. The line, and he has a secretary, you know, like a secretary of state, who always takes notes on unusual things, you know, because then they become part of something to discover. Because he's, you know, he's extraordinary, but he looks like a human being. So, I mean, he is a human being, but you follow what I mean. There's a part of him that's a little bit more functional than we are. He stops the line. He calls a young peasant woman to him. This is, I think, between 9 and 10, but I'm not sure. He's in 17 incarnation now. He says to her, would it be okay if I came to visit you? You know, so his secretary's like, why is he asking this? It's his mother in the next incarnation. You know. So I'm looking around, here's my mom coming up. But you know, having an open psyche, you know, being prophetic, most people who get that capacity want to take it away. Because that's what happened for my teacher, Samuel Lewis. He was very prophetic, and at one point he said, I just prayed, would you just take this away? It's too painful. My music guru was very prophetic. If you can believe that in 1977, I'm sitting having a music lesson with my guru brother, Terry Riley, next to me. And he's teaching us Indian music. And I didn't know he understood palmistry. I knew he understood astrology, but he says, in the middle of our lesson, you know, like off the cuff, he says, no, very interesting line you have in your hand. I said, well, what's that, Guruji? He said, looks like you'll be the head of the Sufis. 1977, you know. I don't know how he knew that, Maybe he didn't know how he knew it, you know, and doesn't matter, you know. So it's not too important. If I'm looking for a being that I want to emulate, attune to, I'm not looking for someone who has lots of visions, or I'm looking for someone who has strength and courage and kindness and compassion, affection and sympathy and gratitude and patience and tolerance and a great capacity to be in tune with the infinite. That to me is the sign of a real spiritual being. Yes? We're going to take you just as you are and be as affectionate as we can and loving. And, yeah. You could have given us stock market tips. That would be the joke. So you hope that along with the gift you get in the long run, that you develop the strength and stamina and ability to carry them. And so it was probably wise, you know, to not be burdened by them, by that ability, you know. And so let's go on. I feel like we can go on from this subject of life after death. Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry. This is more just then a sense for me for you to get him to know, to get to know Murshid Sam through my eyes and my experience. And I think my favorite story about him is the one that I actually learned from Wali Ali, because I wasn't there. So I think many of you have heard it, but it's so worthy of telling here, even though it's not where we're going to go. There was a class at the Mentor Garden. That means that small room in the house where Wally's living now, upstairs. You know, usually 15 people were there, you know, not 50. A fellow walks in, clearly deranged. Used to happen often in the 60s, or more often. He interrupts very boldly. God, he says to Murshid, he points and says, God has appointed me to be your spiritual teacher. Says to Murshid. Murshid jumps up from his chair. He says, I accept on one condition. The fellow says, well, what's that? He says, you show me one person in this room whom God has not appointed to be my spiritual teacher. The fellow, you know, like, he sat down, he attended the class, and that was that. Yeah. Okay. I'd been traveling with Murshid in the fall of 1970. We came back right after Thanksgiving, so December, and he started a Monday morning men's dance class. He picked about seven or eight of us, so it was just for a few of us. And he wanted to help. My sense is it was, you know, a lot of Jalal practices for us to develop strength and confidence. You know, if you were around during that period, it wasn't that easy to have a job, because there was a Sunday afternoon dance class, a Sunday night, a Sunday afternoon walks class. Sunday night was Dharma night, your teachings from the Dharma, you know, Sanskrit, Hindu or Buddhist. Now I had Monday morning men's dance class. Monday night was Sufi night, so it was teachings from Inayat Khan. Tuesday night, we had Sufi choir rehearsal. Wednesday night was the public dance class at the San Francisco Theological Seminary. Thursday night was the Gatha Geetha class. Friday night was a Sufi choir rehearsal. Saturday afternoon was the Saturday afternoon walks class. And Saturday night was the advanced dance class. Yeah, who needs a job? After you give me the $250 million for this, then we can get money for that. In any case, so the Sunday night class was in the mentor garden downstairs. Now it's all very fancy. Then it was concrete garage, you know. And so I slept in the living room, the front room of the mentor garden on the floor. So did Murshid Sam's treasurer at the time, a man named Halim Welch. Wali Ali lived there with him, so that was the three of us. And I think it was December 28th, so it was right after our little Christmas festivities. Now, we celebrated all the, he used to say, we celebrate the feasts of all religions and the fasts of none. One of his one-liners. So some of you know Iqbal, you know Iqbal and Davy, some of you know them. Iqbal had gone to Jerusalem to do a 40-day retreat, and so he had given me his yellow Chevy Impala convertible to use while he was gone. You know, black top, yellow body, and a, yeah. So that car was parked in front of the mentor garden. And it's 5 in the morning, and Halim wakes me up, give me the keys to the car. Murshid fell down the stairs. Yeah. Don't worry. It happened. Yeah. Yeah. Even that tendency to go, oh no, it's going to stop your breath, so you can't be ready to serve in a powerful way. You know, take it in, relax so that you can be useful. Sure, it sucks. You know, I agree. Any case, obviously, I'm not going to give him the keys. I got up. By that time, someone had telephoned Saul. Most of you know Murshid Saul. He lived up on Ripley Street, was just 2 blocks away, and he was Murshid's, healer. So it's Murshid, Wali Ali, Saul, Halim, and myself. Murshid is wearing his brown robe because I think he used to sleep in it. You know, it's kind of was his nightgown, so to say. We don't know why he fell down the stairs. It could be very easily that he was just adjusting the thermostat and tripped on his robe. He could have had a, you know, TIA or a, you know, I mean, I'm sure they did cardiograms afterwards and didn't find a heart attack. Otherwise, we would have heard that. But he could have easily blacked out for whatever reason. In any case, we carried him into the car or helped him into the car. He wasn't lucid, so you couldn't have a conversation with him, but he was reciting. You know, in the one of the prayers, it says, all-powerful creator, sustainer, judge, and forgiver of our shortcomings, Lord God of the East and the West. So he's, you could say mumbling, all-powerful creator, all-powerful creator, all-powerful, just again and again, looping. We drive him to San Francisco General. I think it's a dive now, but it was a super dive then. San Francisco General Hospital. Wali Ali and Halim, who really have the details of name, bank account, they go to the desk of the ER to admit him. And now we've got Murshid lying on a gurney, you know, a rolling bed, Saul and I. And because he's kind of, he wants to get out of the, out, you know, he wants to get out of what's going on. He's not comfortable. We have to pin our teacher to the gurney. So I've got his legs pinned, you know, and Saul's got his arms pinned. And again, these are my memories. So Mershad now is, he's going in between. He's going, all power for a creator, all power for a creator. Get me out of here. What the hell are we doing here? Get me out of here. So Saul, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to shock you, but that's how it was, you know. Saul is trying to be reasonable, you know. Mershad, the reason we're, I said, shut up, get me out of here. You know, he's yelling at Saul. You know, there's kind of that exchange. We're here because, no, I said, shut up, get me away from, you know. So, and what I remember is at one point, Saul loosens his grip and, you know, his arm goes just flying and hits him square in the face. not hurt him, but it was like, you know. So then he is admitted, he has a broken arm, and clearly he's got a concussion. And he also had hives, and you know, he's trying to get out, like when they have to strap him down for the x-ray, you know, it's all very dramatic. And then what's it called? Intensive care? The ICU. What's called ICU now? It's old World War II style, you know, meaning there's no rooms. Everybody's in the same room, you know, like, again, these are my memories. So that's what I remember. And we get permission to have two marids or two people by his side 24 hours a day. So I don't remember, a 6-hour shift, 8-hour shift, something. And Saul managed the shifts. A lot of interesting things happened during that period. You know, mostly unconscious, but every now and then he would get conscious and say a few things to someone. So there were a couple of humorous things that, you know, stories that floated to the top. One of his very, very shy women marids was there with him, and you know, lovely person, still alive today. And he'd say, "Come closer, come closer." And finally, he gets really close, and he grabs her and gives her a big kiss on the mouth. Another one, his disciple Omar Matthews, George Matthews, lives in New York. He says, "Give me your hand, give me your hand." And he gives him his hand. He bites his hand. You know, you never know what kind of karmic magic is going on. So if someone's your teacher and you trust them, then you just trust it, you know. Now, don't get confused that if some teacher acts, you know, irresponsibly, that you should trust it. You know, don't ever lose your common sense. But for me, I had a lot of trust in Samuel Lewis as a teacher, and so when things happened, I tried to see what they were for me. So you got to balance the two. Don't lose your common sense, or as Joe Miller used to tell us, he says there was only three things you need for the spiritual path: common sense, a sense of humor, and more common sense. Then he had a stroke, and you know, he couldn't remember his name. He couldn't at first. He couldn't remember, you know, where he was, what day. And he says, "Oh, I've got the fourth thing." He says, "I said, what's that, Joe?" He says, "Just remember, the joke's on you." These are good. Take it in. Don't be afraid. But anyway, back to Mershad Sam. The most dramatic moment was about, I could look it up, I think it was January 8th, so about 10 days in, Saul and a man named Daniel Lomax, who used to live in Tucson, he started the first center in Tucson. Abdurrahman was his Sufi name. He showed up, and he in the earlier part of the before Wally Ali, he was Merced's secretary. No longer his secretary, and but Merced was supposed to visit Tucson in January, and it was going to be one of those first visits out of the nest, you know. So it wouldn't be just San Francisco centric. Now there was something happening in Tucson. So Abdurrahman and Saul come in. Merced sits up in his bed. He's conscious, completely conscious. Says to Abdurrahman, again, this is a story that I've been told, so it's third hand. What the hell are you doing here? You're supposed to be in Tucson. So Abdurrahman wants to have a kind of a smart answer. So Merced's hair, he had let his hair grow long like we had long hair, and he had a long beard like we did, and his hair was all matted. So Abdurrahman had a hairbrush. So he answered, he says, well, Merced, I've come to brush your hair. Merced says, I ought to brush the inside of your head. and then he says, you know, because this man has been his secretary, or that's how I understand. He said, take down this letter. And he dictates his last letter. I'll read it to you. It's because even from the letter, you can't tell. I couldn't tell. Because, let's see, I'll find it for you first. Abdurrahman distributes the letter, if you want to say it. You know, he gives it to all of us. And I'd been enamored of calligraphy. You know, I used to get jobs doing calligraphy for restaurants, menus, and things like that. So I made a calligraphy of it. There it is, you know. I mean, you can't see much of it. Yeah, hold it up. Probably. It's somewhere, yeah. I'm not sure. I'll send it to Barakat again. And here, let me do that right now. Again, remember my guru is teaching, one-time work doing is the best. You know, now I'll send it to Barakat. She can send it to all of you. It's in the garden, you know, the new version and the old version. Okay, so it was, I'm wrong about the date. It was on January 2nd. So he fell on the 28th. So 28, 29, 30, 31, 1, 2, 6 days. So 6 days in. Here's the letter. Praise be to Allah. This has been a glorious exit, and one which will go down in history, a sign of all the beauty, truth, and goodness in the universe. One has been truly saved from the jaws of death and adversity, and may live on indefinitely as God wills. It is the sign of all symbol and goodness, and the establishment of God's message in the Western world forever. Praise be to Allah. For I am the first one born in the West to have received the divine message and believed to have representatives in all the purity and goodness of which Allah is capable, and which will now be presumed done forever. And this was a letter he sent to his living Sufi teacher in Pakistan, Sufi Barakat Ali. Want me to read it to you again? It's a kind of a cipher or whatever. I don't know what the right word is, you know. What's it saying? You know. First it says it's a glorious exit. I'll live on indefinitely, you know. Okay. Praise be to Allah. This has been a glorious exit, and one which will go down in history, a sign of all the beauty, truth, and goodness in the universe. One has been truly saved from the jaws of death and adversity, and may live on indefinitely as God wills. It is the sign of all symbol and goodness and the establishment of God's message in the Western world forever. Praise be to Allah. For I am the first one born in the West to have received the divine message and believe to have representatives in all the purity and goodness of which Allah is capable and which will now be presumed done forever. So, it was, he finally got a room where, which was shared at San Francisco General, and then there was a movement, you know, I'm a little low, what do you say, lower on the food chain, or, you know, so I'm not in the deciding body, I only hear about things, but, so he's moved to Chinese Hospital, which had a much more quiet atmosphere, you know, suited his Buddhist nature. And then one day we were working at New Age Natural Foods, which was like the first, you know, fantastic food store. Murshid died. It was 1 p.m. when we got the call. You know, four or five of us worked at this store, so probably wasn't good for the store. We all got, and I'm still so naive that I'm thinking, oh no, he's just, you know, he's doing some kind of hibernation thing, you know, for healing. So I don't know. I'm not sure if that was the story, but there you go. No, he was not by himself. There was always two disciples at his side. Definitely not by himself. Plus, his consciousness was vast. He was never by himself. Yeah. But not, you meant physically. Yeah. No, there were two Marids. Wali Ali's ex-wife was there, Khadija, and a lady named Vashti, another one of Murshid's. Two women were with him when he died. Yeah. Well, that means a lot to me, but I'd rather keep it. I mean, I'll tell you, but I don't want to advertise that because it's not a competition. But from the Sufi languaging, there are stages of development in the spiritual hierarchy of awakening. Different stages, the highest stage being Rasul, next stage Nabi, Wali, Gauss. So, from my point of view, from my understanding, or that he had come to a very awakened stage of being, and in that way, the first one in this, you know, in America, that had come to. Obviously, we have Emerson and Thoreau and those beings who touched something profound and deep for us, no doubt about it. But so what it means to me is something like that, that he's really the first, you know, wide open, illuminated being in the Western world. Now, clearly, that can't be right because how many thousands of year history for the native families? No, known and unknown. So, and once he dictated somebody something like this, it wasn't him speaking wasn't speaking in some kind of prideful way. He was, you know, letting the universe speak. So I just take it to mean that he was very awake. And, you know, in a way that makes this shrine all the more important. It makes the biography that we hope Wali Ali gets gets permission to complete so important to because we're talking, you know, we're now we're talking about, we're still in his lifetime, you know, or 45 years. Some of us, many of us were still alive when he was born in this planet. But what's it going to be like in 100 years and 200 years and 500 years? And he indicated to us that he would become famous proportionally to the number of years he died. You know, so 2 times 4 times 8 times 16 times 32. So in some ways, we're in our infancy as a lineage sharing the blessing stream out of this enormous being from a disciple's point of view. Yeah, so that's what it means to me. Yeah. I wanted to give what I feel is an important teaching. We talked about purpose of life, and we somehow all came to a view of limitless freedom. Now, we're of very different ages and different experiences in life, but through each of our lives, we've each had the feeling like, okay, what do you want me to do? You know, what should I do so I can serve this intuitive feeling of being beneficial that we each have? You know, I want to be beneficial. What's my purpose? You know, what's my purpose? And, you know, in our society, if you got to be able to choose doctor, lawyer, okay, that's good. After that, it's like, you know, nurse was a good thing. Nurses are the best, no doubt. They are the kindest. And so many of us have had that feeling. I certainly had that feeling. You know, when I was with Murshid, and after that first 10 years, I taught music, I made musical instruments, I led Sufi things, but I kept feeling like, what do you want me to do? You know, how? And then a retail store fell in the lap of my wife and I. And now for 20 years, we're retailers. Now, you'd be hard pressed to say, he finally found the purpose of his life. A retailer. Joe Miller would tease us. He says, your 5,000 years of genetic, you know, Jewish genetic history caught up with you. Oy. Sell something. So how did we negotiate that? We made a mission statement for our corporation that our corporation should be of benefit. So then we tried to apply the mission statement to every aspect of business. Employers to employees, employees to employers. And I trained all my employees in this. I said, this is our mission statement. Here's how we can apply it. Talking to vendors. You know, if I called a vendor, first thing I'd say, hello, this is a human being. Is there a human being there? You know, then you'd get, you know, the hookup. And then we'd talk about, what was up, you know. Why did you do this? Why didn't you send money to, et cetera. So then this happens. I'm the peer. Well, it's clear to me now, music practice, teaching music, making musical instruments, learning how to run a business, reading a profit and loss statement, having a balance sheet, learning how to borrow money, learning how to pay money back, talking to vendors, talking to employers, talking to all of that was for this. Well, and what's this for? Something, you know. So I want to suggest a change in approach so that at every day we can feel like we're on our purpose. You want to get it? Okay. So. The first suggestion is to switch from what am I supposed to do to how. So You know, I call this my 8-point program. Oh, and maybe it's nine. The number keeps changing because there's so many good points. But the principle is to keep an aspiration in your heart. And you could say, when you arise in the morning, make an aspiration to develop strength and courage. I mean, so those related and the same, you know, different, same but similar. Strength and courage. And why would I put those at the beginning? And I think I mentioned this yesterday. You won't accomplish anything without strength. You can have the best guidance of what to do. You know, you have a dream and it says, do this. You don't have strength, you can't do it. So strength and courage, points 1 and 2. 3 and 4, now you can concentrate on kindness and compassion. Right? So I'm making this aspiration. Strength, courage, kindness, compassion. Now, we need the ability to tolerate this plane, which has a lot of tough elements. So we need tolerance. Now, tolerance, you could call it tolerance and patience. You could say tolerance and forgiveness. You put in which words you want there, but say, you know, tolerance and patience. When you study Yasabur, it's not an intolerant patience. It's a real patience. So you're at ease while I needed patience to work on this project. I just stayed on. My guidance said to stay on it. I can't tell you how many times it'd say, Mershad, want me to stay with this? Yes. I'm not saying I'm right or that's Mershad's voice or anything. Don't. This is no claim on my part. I'm just telling you my process. Yeah. Okay. So strength, courage, kindness, compassion, tolerance, patience. Now you can add one more in there because, and someone pointed out, my path is gratitude, someone said yesterday. So gratitude. And then the last one, to be in tune with the infinite. To be in tune with the infinite. Lunchtime, make same aspiration. I want to bring wherever I am, strength, courage, kindness, compassion, tolerance, patience, gratitude, in tune with the infinite. How many points is that? It's the 8-point program. It used to be a 7. Yeah? Good. At dinner time, evening time, go to bed, make the same aspiration. So that's what you're in your heart to. And then you just, from where you are, you carry on in this way. Naturally, because you have that aspiration, if the situation you're in needs to change, it will change. And if the situation is difficult and needs to stay the same, it will stay the same for you to develop. You know, it takes time to get your rock polished. You have to be in a rock tumbler. You know, it's a great image. I was with, this is a beautiful, I was with the great Houston Smith, you know, who's still alive today, and a really beautiful human being. And Tamam and I had the pleasure of sitting with him. It was about 4 or 5 years ago. And he said to me, the first thing he says, you know, because he knows we're disciples of Samuel Lewis, he says, I think your teacher was the happiest person I ever met. And then, it was in the 70s, you know, 60s when he met him. And then when the Sufi choir came on, he says, and I played your Sufi choir record for my class all the time. He says, I didn't know if you were real Sufis, but I love that music. And then he would start singing, Bismillah, Iraq. You know, he's singing one of the cuts of the record, you know. So he says to Tamam, tell me everything about you. Start at the beginning and don't leave anything out. I mean, the guy's 90, you know. He's just a consummate, you know, sweetness. You know, I'd been to lectures that he'd give, and I learned from him. Someone would ask a question, and he'd say, I love that question. That is a fantastic question. Then, you know, he'd answer that. Then the next question, he'd say, that is a brilliant question. That's the subject of my next book. You know, so at some point in the conversation, we're very proudly telling him, you know, and we've been married, you know, whatever it was. Now we're 40, but, you know, we've been married 35 years. And so he says, I don't know about marriage, but my partner and I have been honing each other's rough edges for 60 years. And I still have rough edges. Yeah. So we don't know what life's purpose is. Well, we do. We know life's purpose for us is to provide the quickest path to limitless freedom. You know, that's my point of view. So that means I no longer have the average point of view that, why do I have such bad karma? You know, why are bad things happening? There must be something wrong. It's just not my point of view. There must be something wrong. Why did I get cancer? What did I do wrong? Why did I lose my money? Why did my son die? And it must be doing, I just don't have that point of view. I don't mean it's not valid. It's just such an average point of view. It doesn't do much. It doesn't. I feel that whatever is arising is the universe's quickest plan for limitless freedom for the benefit of all sentient beings. So whatever arises, right away, I feel like it's murshid, or however you say it, you know, to see the teacher in everything. Thank you for arising to help limitless freedom have its way. So whether it's the case or not, it works pretty well. You have a better time, I can tell you that. But I feel it very strongly. That's very paradoxical. Okay, so you're so right. I love that question. let's see, I'll try to give you some anecdotes. I'm just picking a middle of Mershid's diary notes. I came back to Delhi to go to the Dargah of Nizamuddin Awliya. I arrived at 10:30 at night and they were waiting for me. No attempt will be made here to go into the psychic and the telepathic and other elements which do not belong in this conversation. On the next, in other words, he arrived to go to on a pilgrimage to this shrine of a Sufi Satan. All the people were waiting for him to arrive. On the next day, I went with the peer and his brother, and we visited the tombs, the four tombs of Nizamuddin Awliya, Amir Khusro, Hasan Nizami, and Hazrat Inayat Khan. There was a vision in each case, but here there was at least one living witness also, men who are accepted by the community. For our purposes, we shall limit these to the one. When I stood before the tomb of the great Urdu poet, Hazrat Amir Khusro, he appeared with a robe, a khirka, exactly the same as I had seen before. I initiate you into the school of Jalaluddin Rumi and as the successor of the late great poet, Muhammad Iqbal. He was one of the great living Sufi poets of the previous century. My poetry had already been written, but I had 100% rejections in my home country. When I returned to Pakistan, there was a waiting crowd of some 200 people, and we had a long ceremony in which the actual robe was bestowed. One didn't need go into the mystery of the robe here. The ceremony was quite long, and there was a big feast too, and other factors, including spiritual dancing. As this was, there's some wonderful dire experiences. So the same paradox you ask about completely confounds me. Yeah. Because I know if Murshid is anywhere, he's going to be everywhere. You know, why would I get confused? So following in my teacher's footsteps, I've grown to love pilgrimage of going to the, what'd you say, gateway? Yeah, going to this gateway at the tomb of a saint, putting my head down and opening myself up to guidance. And that's been an experience I've had that he's had. So it's in the Sufi tradition. It's been, for more than a thousand years. He goes to Inayat Khan's tomb. He describes Inayat coming to him. All experience after experience. So, again, when I told this story, I quoted him by saying he had said to us, there's not enough places like this in America, and I would like my shrine to have that service to humanity, to be a pilgrimage place where people can come for guidance. And I think I also said that it has been that for the last 45 years. So it's not like you need the building for that to happen. The building is there, in my mind, to give him a better place to teach from. It's improving the environment for you to sit and receive guidance. Beautiful. Yeah, but I think the point that Yakin's making very, very valuable is that where an activity is held, the place absorbs the atmosphere of that activity. And a very stark realization of it is if you go, like you're looking to buy a home, and you go into a home and nobody's living in it, it doesn't have, you have to imagine, it doesn't have life. It's very kind of empty. And so you come into a home where there's been a loving atmosphere, you feel love. You go into a home where there's a lot of turmoil, you feel the turmoil. And places like Sufi shrines are, a collection of baraka, of blessing. But here's an Ayat Khan himself tells this story about a king got sick, and he went to the shrine of a healer, and he got better. And so he was so enamored of that healer, and that healer then moved to another village. Oh no, sorry. He went to the healer, and then he praised the healer, and the healer said, no, it's not me. And the king said, I don't believe that. So the healer said to him, let me have your slippers. And the king gave his slippers. Then he disappeared, and he moved to another village, and he built a shrine, and he put the king's slippers in the center of the shrine. And then years later, the king got sick again, and he, you know, his best spies, whatever, you know, found out that that healer was in another village, and there was a beautiful healing center. And he went there, and he prayed by the shrine, and he got better. And he said to the healer, see, I was right. You have great healing powers. And then the healer said, wait, let me show you what you were praying to. And he opens the shrine, and it's his own slippers. So, you know, it's hard for me to give you an answer, that the definitive answer. Is it the place? Is it the collection of barakah? Is it your devotion? It's got to be all of those together. But experientially, we can record that it is a place of blessing. There used to be, before the fire, you know, there was a darga hut, you know, where you would do a three-day, you know, you'd rent it from Lama, and you'd do a retreat. And there was a book in there, like, you know, like a guest book. And you could read through it when you were there. And it was experience after experience after experience of people saying how Murshid had guided them. I don't really care if he guided them or it was their mind. I don't care. But by them making the effort to go to a place and open themselves up, something wonderful happened. So I know that to be the case at this place, and I know that to be the place that where Yaqeen's talking about, and many places. And the facility as it was, because now it's being dug up, you couldn't be there for more than a half an hour in the sun. It's too now. So I'm trying to give the guidance, the spirit of guidance, a better facility to guide from. How's that? In a very, you know, in a tradition, yes. Yes, somewhat. Beautiful. I'm convinced. I also know the saying, if you see the Buddha in the road, kill him. What does that mean? It means that what you're looking for is not outside of you. But we have to be honest. Let me give this. What time are we going to have lunch? Is it here? Okay. So let me give you this. Come sit down. I think this is a very beautiful and important part of understanding the journey we're on from the Sufi point of view. When we understand La ilaha illallah, or what I've just said, we know God is everywhere. And in fact, we realize this thought of self is insubstantial. There's only God. We say it every day. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah. It's very much what in today's world is called Advaita, non-dual. It's completely non-dual. There is no such thing as a lover and a beloved. That's absurd. It is. And Anaya tells the Sufi story about Moses. You remember this story? Moses is comes across this young peasant boy who's by the stream, and Moses says, "Well, what are you doing?" And the peasant boy says, "Well, I've set a table because I want to feed lunch to God, and I've got a hairbrush to brush his hair." And Moses says to him, "No, no, no. God isn't a person. You know, that's foolish. God is the all-pervading presence of everything." And the young man got very confused, and Moses walking along feeling, you know, proud that he's done a good thing. And then Gabriel shows up. "Moses, we're very displeased with you." "Why?" He says, "We sent you to unite us with our lovers, not separate." So, you know, feeling that God is everywhere, that there is no I separate from God, well, which direction do you turn? What prayer should we recite? What aspiration should we recite? Who's the reciter? How do we view ourselves? And how do we navigate or negotiate the non-dual with our current experience, which, far as I can tell, it's quite dual. We feel self and other. So how do we negotiate that? Okay, so I'm going to read you Anayat's teaching. It's here? Okay, this won't take long. It'll wait for us. He says, "A friend who is a friend in life and after death, in pleasure and pain, in riches and poverty, one upon whom one can always depend, who always guides rightly, who gives the best advice, that friend is hidden in one's heart. One cannot find a better one. Who is this friend? One's own being, our true inner being. That friend is the origin, the source, and the goal of all. But the question arises, if that friend is our very self, one's own being, then why call him a friend? Why not call it one's self?" Want to hear the answer? Okay. The answer is that no doubt this friend is really one's being, but when the greater self is compared with our present realization, one finds oneself smaller than the drop in the ocean. We cannot very well call that friend our self until we have forgotten ourself. Until we are no more ourself. Until and unless one has arrived at that state of perfection, one had better be quiet and not insolent, talking about that which one has not yet become. You like it? Yeah. It's fascinating. And when you look into this, what we call the Sufi path, we see it's the path of the lover. As Rumi said, the beloved is all in all. The lover, just a veil, not a real thing. So knowing what we do, why would we be so, you know, why would we act like the lover? Well, if you can remember one time when you'd really fallen in love, were you thinking about yourself? Were you intoxicated? You know, no thought of self, no appetite anymore, vitality, joy, you know, stamina, everything, because you'd merged in the love, the beloved. And so the path of the lover is the most reliable path to overcome the thought of self quickly. Because you become the beloved. So we lean on that. We lean on the path of love, being the lover, knowing all the while we're a little confused. Or, no, we're not confused. God is confused. Okay, last thing I want to share is one of my favorite sayings of Hazrat Inayat Khan. He says, the work of the Sufi has nothing to do with any particular religion, any particular creed, philosophy, race, but just this simple thing. He uses those words. To be able to keep one's rhythm throughout life's conditions and to be in tune with the infinite. To be able to keep one's rhythm throughout life's conditions and to be in tune with the infinite. So what does it mean to be able to keep one's rhythm? It's the same thing we're saying, that our condition is no longer based on circumstance, that nothing can arise to take you out of the rhythm of your being and to be in tune with the infinite. Then he goes on to say, he says, but somehow we get confused because we think if life would just now change to what we want, we would be happy. But he says, this is an inexperienced expectation. He says, even it will change to what you want, in no time again, wanting will arise. Just like we said in the beginning yesterday, that thirst will keep arising until we wake up and see that what we're looking for is our very self. Yeah. Okay. Let's have lunch. Yes. So let's dedicate then, and then we can have our announcement. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. Me.